The field turns for home.
They're at the top of the stretch.
Top of the stretch.
They're into the stretch.
And here they come into the final furlong.
Final furlong.
Final furlong.
Into the final furlong.
They go inside the final furlong.
This is the final furlong on HRRN Live. HRRN Live. It's Trainer Talk Wednesday. Now, here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to this Trainer Talk edition of the Final Furlong Show here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, the Pontiff of the Pick Four, our producer Lee Della Pina back off the layoff, coming back from a bit of a vacation, well rested and pushing all the buttons for us here in studio. Let's hope he remembers how to do that, JT.
I hope so. Richly deserved vacation. The guy's been doing a yeoman's job here at the old
studio.
Well,
he has to make us sound good, so.
That's an impossible task.
It is absolutely impossible. But our special guest on tonight's Trainer Talk will certainly make us sound good. Trainer Brett Calhoun is going to join us in the first half of the program, and then Alan Goldberg will be here in the second half. So a lot of neat things to look forward to over the next hour or so here on Trainer Talk.
Yeah, it's going to be a good show. I am looking forward to talking to both of these guys.
Well, we do begin with the 49-year-old native of Dallas, Texas. Let's welcome in Brett Calhoun, who is closing in on 2,200 career wins. And no better way to welcome him.
Deep in the heart of Texas, the prairie sky is wide and high.
Brett, how's that for making you feel at home?
I make you feel right at home. Yeah, I don't get to spend much time in Texas anymore, but that is home for me, and I really like that area a lot, and I wish they could have a little more success with their horse racing there. So one of these days I could go back there and spend more time.
Yeah, well, coincidentally, that is the same song that George Strait enters to when he comes into the arena for his concert. So you're in lofty company.
Very good.
Well, Brett, as I mentioned, this show very much about you and your life and your background in the world of racing and how you got started. I mentioned those 2,200 career winners. The runners you've sent out have accumulated purse earnings of, nearly $52 million. But I'm curious, you're a kid growing up in Dallas, Texas. How does horse racing come into your life?
Well, it's kind of funny. Like I said, I grew up in the city between Dallas and Fort Worth there. And we didn't have pari-mutuel wagering at that time in Texas. We had no racetracks. All they had was, you know, a few bush tracks. And so it is strange that I got involved in it. But how I got started was my parents were just racehorse fans. They liked going to the races. And they would go to Hot Springs, or they'd go to Louisiana Downs or to Delta or someplace, you know, close to a few hours drive to go to the races. And I learned at a young age to read the racing form and started sending my $2 with them to bet, and that's how I started, you know, kind of getting involved and knowing the business and liking it. And of course, I was like every other young kid that age. You're always wanting a horse, and you know, I was bugging my parents for a horse all the time, and they were like, yeah, maybe someday, you know. And so, you know, I kept bugging them about that. So instead of just getting an everyday pony riding horse, my dad decided to get involved in the racehorse business, and so just bought a few way back, and so that's how it all got started for me.
Were you one of those kids that was sitting in school with his racing form open under his textbook?
Well, it wasn't quite that bad, but I'll tell you, if I would have paid attention in school and tried as hard in school through junior high school and college, there's no telling where I could have gotten, but and my parents always kid me, if I'd have spent that much time and effort in school as I did on the horse and trying to learn the horse business as a young kid, you know, things might have been different.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. The nun didn't like it when I did my first book report on a book called Making Money at the Races in third grade.
Yeah, that's kind of about where mine was going. I did reports and things like that on the horse racing business.
Is your dad, is he still involved in the business, Brad? Or
no, not really. You know, they just they always enjoyed the sport. Of course, they kind of live through me and keep up with the horses. But, you know, I'll put them in a horse every once in a while. They go to they still live in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and they go to the races a lot of times on weekends when I have horses running out there, and or they're watching the TV at night and watching them all over the place.
Now, before you made the decision to become a trainer, you actually did attend college. You went to Texas Tech University. You're a Red Raider. Was Correct. That horse racing related or horse related, or was this for a separate career?
Well, it was not supposed to be horse related. I went to Tech. My parents, you know, had a few horses all during that time. I stayed somewhat involved in the business. My parents had bred and raised some horses, and that's how it started out. We didn't really start out racing. We started out breeding and raising, and then started racing a few. And I stayed involved somewhat with it all the way through college and high school and college. And but really, that's all I ever wanted to do. And I was trying to figure out a way to make a living in the industry, and that's really what I wanted to do. My parents really weren't too excited about me getting into the industry full time. They knew it was a tough way to make a living, and they thought I should be trying something different. So when I went to college, I was in the business side of had a business degree major, and actually after a couple of years, I actually changed all the way into animal science for a year. And so yes and no, it really wasn't in the horse industry so much, but it gave me a little bit more background, and then I ended up going back into the business end. When I got out of college, I took a job for about 5 years selling advertising, print advertising, but I continued to stay involved in the business along the way as much as I could. I would get up and go exercise horses in the morning at 5 o'clock in the morning before I would go to my job. So I kind of stayed somewhat involved along the way. And then my parents retired from their jobs, and they decided they were going to just take their few horses on the road themselves and race them. And I think after a very short while, they figured out that was not what they thought was retired life was about. 7 days a week, 365. So how it all actually came together for me was, you know, I'd been a student of the game business for a long time. I'd put a lot of time and effort watching, and so they took their stable, the small stable, about five or six horses to Louisiana Downs one summer, and I had given my resignation. I had about 4 weeks vacation saved up, and I turned in my resignation, and I was just going to help my parents go set up down there for the summer. And I went down there to help them get everything set up. I was going to be down there for a week or so, and then I was going to come back and interview for some more jobs. And I went down there for the week, and I never came back. And I've pretty much been on the road and involved in training ever since. And this is my 21st year to be doing it.
That was a pretty savvy ploy by your parents to suck you into that, huh?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because they did. They said, look, we're not going to do this. This isn't for us. We're not going to do this. And I don't think it's a smart move on your part, but here it is. And, you know, there was, you know, four or five cheap claimers, and, you know, they were pretty beat up. And I was pretty pretty adamant about doing it. And, of course, obviously, it was, as anything else, it was a lot of down times, and there was some up times back then, but there was way more down than there was up. And, you know, really don't know how I've gotten this far. Luckily I was able to survive it and have a pretty good stable put together.
Well, and your dad was a school teacher. Was mm-hmm. it hard for him to accept the fact that you decided to make a career as a horse trainer, as opposed to maybe pursuing your education a little bit more, or was he supportive?
They've been very, very supportive. I think their biggest concern was, I think, knowing the industry and being around it, they know how hard a life it can be. And, you know, financially, it's not the most secure business in the world at times. So I think that was their biggest fear. They were very supportive about me, you know, kind of chasing my dream and knowing how much I love this business. They weren't too concerned about, you know, me being a school teacher or pursuing more education. They were just concerned about how I was going to make a living.
You know, when people talk about horse trainers and the 7 days a week and all that, they often wonder how people can do it. But I bet you think that you never go to work a day in your life, really.
You know, like you said, it's at times it's wearing and long hours. But if you start thinking about another career, you start thinking how you probably couldn't do that. So you're right. I think I'm very fortunate to do something that I love, and it's not near like a job as a lot of people think about their job.
Brett Calhoun, our special guest on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Brett, you decided to take out your trainer's license, as you mentioned, at Louisiana Downs. That was, what, 1993, I guess, and you're training horses that were, you know, bred by your dad. It didn't take you long to win your first race. You did that April 1st, 1994. That was at Trinity Meadows. There's a name we don't hear very often.
Yeah, you know, like I said, when I started in all this, we didn't even have a paramutual track in Texas. And really, Trinity Meadows evolved from an old bush track over there. And that's some of the first tracks we got in Texas was the Sam Houston Race Park. And then Trinity Meadows was already there. And then they made it a paramutual track. And it's funny because the horses I had were so cheap that, honestly, at that time, I didn't want to get very far from home because I didn't know how long it was going to last with those horses. So I stayed within a few hundred miles of home in case things went really bad.
What was the name of that first winner?
Ramjet, I believe, was his name. Ramjet, I believe.
And that was one of your dad's horses?
Yeah, sure was.
More special winning a race when the horse is owned by your dad or a family member, or is it more special when you can win a big race for somebody else?
You know, back then it was just blood, sweat, and tears, and just to win a race, period, early on was very special. And no matter who owned it, you know, I had a lot invested in it. You know, basically, dad had said, here's the horses, and you can take them and it'll be on a lease deal. So that was pretty much how I was making my income also.
Boy, he really did you a favor.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, put the pressure on me early. I think he was trying to help me get out of the game early on.
Yeah, the baptism of fire. Well, that's funny. That's really, you know, it's always been my experience that training for your parents, it can be a nightmare. The first guy that I worked for, his dad never used to pay his training bill. He used to drive him crazy. So I know how that goes.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because really my mom and my dad back then were very supportive. They'd come out, they'd help, they'd muck stalls, walk hots, they did it all. They've been very, very supportive. I was kind of a one-man show in the early days. I was the groom, the hot walker, the exercise rider, did it all. And, you know, they helped out a lot too back then.
There's no better way to learn than that way, though, the learn by doing method. I mean, you really get a good feel for the game right off the bat.
I did. You know, I think a lot of people, you know, don't come up that way. I think there's this day and age, you might need to go with a big time trainer, be an assistant for a Baffert, a Lucas, a Pletcher, or some one of those guys to really learn the game and to get be able to build a clientele base at this point in time. Back then, I think it worked out well for me. Luckily, I was smart enough to figure out who knew what they were doing and who didn't know what they were doing, and you can learn a lot from both. And just putting a lot of hours in and doing everything, you learn a lot. And then as time went on, the stable grew in size, and I got to train a larger number of horses, and I think that helps a lot. The more different cases you can see, the more experience you can gain earlier. And it didn't take me 20 years to train large numbers to see a lot of different cases. I was lucky, you know, several years back I was able to train a fairly large stable, and I was able to kind of get experience at a quicker rate.
Yeah, and you mentioned the first winner, Ramjet, April 1st, 1994, Brett. It was over 3 years before you would finally get your first stakes winner in Sweet Misty when she won the Sam Houston Oaks on April 12th of 1997. Was there a feeling at that point that, hey, I've struggled for these 3 years, I've worked my tail off, I finally reached the top of the mountain?
You know, in this game, I'm not sure you ever feel like you've reached the top of the mountain. It's such a humbling business. You know, you can be a hero in the first and a goat in the last and, a lot of times. So I don't ever get too high. But, I mean, obviously, you know, that was an exciting point in time. It was a stakes win for some people from Texas called Margaret and Tommy Landreth, who had been very supported early on in my career. And they had given me really my first break in training. And I trained a horse that was basically kind of got me started besides Fleet Misty. I trained a horse named Cowboy Dan for them. And that horse was a horse that ran second on the undercard at Churchill Downs on Derby Day. And I had brought him from Texas, and he got beat a nose, and I mean a nose and head bob, to Favorite Trick in the WHAS that day. And Favorite Trick went on to be the horse of the year as a two-year-old that year. And as you guys know, that doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
So that was a very special two-year-old for me and kind of got me jump-started. Shortly thereafter, that horse was sold. We sold him to Danny Hutt, who became a friend of mine. And the horse went on and did well. And then Danny gave him back to me and let me run him a little bit, and we'd switch him back and forth some. But the key to that was I was financially in a pretty tough spot at that time in my life. We sold that horse for a lot of money. And they sent me a very, very healthy commission check, and it pretty much got me out of debt at that point in time and was able to continue to move forward.
Well, Brett, you obviously made a name for yourself racing primarily in Louisiana and in Texas. You had a streak where you won 7 consecutive starters at Lone Star Park in a 4-day span in June of 2011. You were the leading trainer at Lone Star in 2010 and 2011. And then you won 4 races at Fairgrounds on November 30th of 2008. I love this part. With 4 different jockeys. Nobody wanted to ride first call for Brett Calhoun?
I don't think so back then. I couldn't have blamed him.
Talk about some of those streaks. That's very, very impressive.
You know how this business is. You know, it's so much about the condition book and getting in the right races and drawing the right posts. And it just seems like it's feast or famine sometimes in this business. Everything goes good or everything goes terrible a lot of times. There's very little medium ground there. And so, you know, people talk about hot trainers and hot jocks and stuff. And I'm not denying that it doesn't appear that way. It doesn't do that. But a lot of it has to do with, you know, just the luck of the draw, races going that you've been entering and all falling on the same day or same couple of days sometimes.
Yeah, that's why you have to be so careful with your finances, because it does seem to go that way. And I always used to tell my dad, I wish I could just win, you know, 1 or 2 races a month instead of like winning them all at one meet and then go the next meet and, you know, have the occasional winner. I mean, it's tough being up and down like that, but that seems like the way the sport goes.
Well, it's very cyclical, as you guys know, because you've got conditions and you go into one meet and you have a good meet and you run through all those conditions. And everybody's like, man, you're doing great, had a great meet. And then you go to the next meet and you win nothing. And like, oh, well, he's gone bad. He's, you know, he's ice cold. But it just happens to be, you know, you had conditions at one meet. And it's very hard unless you've got a large stable and a lot of turnover to keep going meet after meet because you lose those conditions.
Brett Calhoun, our special guest here on the Horse Racing Radio Network Trainer Talk Show. This is your customary Wednesday night feature here on HRRN. And so, Brett, you hang in there, and then you come to 2003, and along comes a 2-year-old undefeated by the name of Cactus Ridge, and he really did help put you on the map nationally. Talk about Cactus Ridge and that run.
He did. He was a very, very good horse. He never was a very sound horse, and I think we were able to manage him very, very well. And he'd made it all the way through. You know, the Ellis Juvenile used to be a big race back then, and in the Arlington, Washington was a pretty prestigious race at the time, and then that kind of was took us on to the Breeders' Cup. We were going on to the Breeders' Cup from there, and he looked like he was going to be one of the top 3 or 4 choices in the Breeders' Cup, and I worked him before the first race at Hawthorne one day. And he was flying out, I believe, the next day to California. And he slab fractured his knee, which was obviously very disappointing to me at that time because that was the best horse I had trained up till the end, and I thought that was going to kind of help get me, you know, jump starting even to a better horse, a bigger and better thing. And that was a huge disappointment for me. But he was a really good horse, a fun horse to train. Toby Keith owned, so the whole thing was a fun run. And like you said, it kind of helped me out a little bit there. It would have been nice to have made it to the Breeders' Cup with him found and seeing what would happen. But he was a very special horse for me.
Well, what was it like training for Toby Keith?
Well, it was a lot of fun. His whole family was kind of involved. They would come to the races a lot of times. And we had a lot of fun. His sister, mother, grandmother, everybody was kind of involved. They'd show up at the races. And so it was a lot of fun.
Did you get backstage passes?
I sure did. I did go several concerts and go backstage and see Toby.
Yeah, they always say, you know, the only person that can get an executive out of his board meeting is his trainer. So.
I think that's right.
Well, Brett, you talk about the Breeders' Cup and not getting there in that instance, but you've been there a few times. You've had success. You won in 2010 a couple of races, the Filly and Mare Sprint with Dubai Majesty and the Turf Sprint with the old fella Chamberlain Bridge, who Jude and I are really fond of. Talk about those horses and your Breeders' Cup experiences.
Well, 2010 was an extremely special year for me. Winning the two Breeders' Cups was icing on the cake. It made it a huge year. But I will say, even up to that point in time during that year, it was a phenomenal run. We were winning stakes all over the country every weekend. It was just one of those phenomenal runs, had a really good stable, and then ended up winning the two Breeders' Cup races. You know, when we went to the Breeders' Cup that weekend, we had high hopes for Chamberlain Bridge. He'd come into his top form. He'd been very, very good all year. And when we entered, we were very, very confident. And then we drew the one hole, and I think my heart just sank. I just thought we lost all chance at that point in time. And he runs a tremendous race. He's jumping hills in the turn, gets out and wins. But the day before that was Dubai Majesty, and we had to supplement her at a cost of $90,000 or $100,000. So it made it even a little more pressure packed. I told my owners going into that thing, I didn't want to encourage them or twist their arm to put up $90,000 or $100,000, but I felt like we had a really big shot if we drew properly, you know, drew lucky enough to draw outside in that race. I said, if we draw inside and our hands are forced the whole way, you know, it might not be such a good thing. And of course, we got lucky, had the outside post, and she just dominated that group that day. So to win the one on Friday, you're like ecstatic, and then you really, in your back of your mind, you think there's no way you can come back the following day and win another one. And when Chamberlain Bridge was able to get out on the turn, and he just exploded down the lane, it was just a thrill of a lifetime. May not ever have that run again, but it was something that they can never take away, and it was a very, very special weekend.
I bet you that's the weekend that your parents went around telling all their friends what a great idea they had of making you a horse trainer.
Yeah, they were sure happy they guided me to that spot. Yeah.
Were your parents at the Breeders' Cup that year?
They weren't. They stayed home and watched it on TV. You know, like you said, they're very proud of the accomplishments, and like I said, they played a big part of it too in the early days, even though they weren't wanting me to go in that direction. They always helped me and supported me. But it's funny how we talk about the ups and downs of the game. That was a real highlight, 2010 and the Breeders' Cup. And then, you know, when you have a stable like that of, you know, quite a few good horses, well, obviously they don't stay around forever. They retire to the breeding shed. They, you know, retire from old age or this, that, and the other. And so since that time, it's been, you know, a couple of years of okay years, nothing like 2010. It's kind of been a rebuilding since then. And I think, you know, maybe this year we're just starting to see some rebuilding here in the last couple of months, some horses stepping forward and some two-year-olds. So maybe we're going to rebuild and have another good year in the next couple of years.
Well, one horse that you did have the opportunity to be around for quite some time, and I know he's one of your favorites, is King of Speed, who raced until age 11 and made 111 career starts. That's just amazing.
He is one of my all-time favorites, and it's funny you mentioned his name. I got to see him this morning. He, Buff Bradley, and his family, they bred and raised and raced him originally, and after we retired him, we returned him back to them. And he was at Churchill Downs this morning. And King of Steve was at Churchill Downs this morning under attack, believe it or not. He's been there the last 2 days as a stable pony. They bring him in every summer a little bit. So I got to see him today, and he looks fantastic. He retired 100% sound. He won his 100th race for me. He was just an amazing horse all the way through, very sound all the way through, extremely competitive. He's just everything you want in a racehorse, and he was a lot of fun for us. It's nice that he retired sound. He's got a great life out on Buff's farm now.
You never know about old Buff. He's liable to breeze him someday and run him in a week or so. I hope you kept the papers.
That's what I told his assistant this morning. I said, he looked good enough. You might want to put him on the fence and see how he goes. It's funny, when they get done, as competitive as he was, and he brought it just about every time, when he was done, he was just done. There wasn't anything wrong with him physically. He had just gotten to the age and the time in his life that he was done with it, and he showed us that, and so we happily retired him.
Well, Brett, as is usually the case with most of our guests on Trainer Talk, we could spend another half an hour talking with you about your life and your career. I feel like we've just scratched the surface, but we are out of time for this first half of the program. Alan Goldberg coming up next, but do want to say thank you very much for taking the time. All of our guests who appear on Trainer Talk will receive gifts from our sponsors of the show, EPO Equine and Flair Equine Nasal Strip, so we'll take care of you on that. And thanks so much for being here tonight, and looking forward to seeing Brett Calhoun in the winner's circle many more times in the days to come.
Good talking to you guys. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Brett. Brett Calhoun, our special guest. The first half of Trainer Talk.
Deep in the heart of Texas, the prairie.
Alan Goldberg coming up next. Stay tuned. We're back with more on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Attention horsemen, are you getting the most out of your equine athlete? All natural EPO Equine could be the answer. EPO Equine is the most potent blood builder on the market. Top trainers like Scott Lake and Steve Margolis are reporting dramatic improvements in their horses. Easy to use and clinically tested, EPO Equine is the product your horses need for speed, strength, and stamina right out of the gate. Call 215-501-6880 or visit epoequine.com. Breathing easy is the key to equine performance and health. That's why horsemen around the world count on Flair nasal strips to protect the lungs of their equine athletes without drugs. Flair strips' gentle support of the nasal passages reduces the soft tissue collapse that occurs in all horses during intensive exercise. 7 clinical studies prove the benefits of Flair strips for reducing lung bleeding, reducing fatigue, and shortening recovery time. Reduce bleeding, recover faster, perform better. Prevent, protect, perform with Flair strips.
RacehorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RacehorseReport.com. Make RacehorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RacehorseReport.com.
This is Daily Racing Form's Dan Ullman with some big news about DRF bets. Thousands of players like you have already made the switch to DRF bets, and now there's an even bigger reason for you to join. Free DRF PPs. That's right, for the first time ever, get free Daily Racing Form PPs when you wager with DRF bets. These are the DRF past performances you know and love, and DRF bets is the only place you can get them free. So why wager anywhere else? With DRF bets, you'll get the best sign-up bonus in the business, free guides and analysis from DRF's top handicappers, breaking news, analysis, and wagering on the go with DRF and DRF Bets Mobile, one-click multi-ticket wagers with DRF Ticketmaker, and now free Daily Racing Form PPs. Only one place gives you the PPs you prefer when you wager, DRF Bets. Join today and wager with the most trusted name in racing. And if you sign up right now, you'll get a $125 cash bonus. Find out more at drf.com/bets. That's drf.com/bets.
HRRN proudly brings you Thoroughbred Racing's Fastest Day.
the Summit of Speed. Live from Calder Casino and Racecourse, join our Eclipse award-winning broadcast team Saturday, July 6th for live coverage of the Grade 1 Princess Rooney Handicap, the Grade 2 Smile Sprint Handicap, and more. Who will punch their ticket to the Breeders' Cup? Tune in to find out. The Summit of Speed, this Saturday, only on HRRN. It's Trainer Talk Wednesday on the Final Furlong on HRRN Live.
Mike Penna, Jude Feld, back with you on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is the show trainers listen to, and I hope they had a chance to listen to that interview with Brett Calhoun in the first half of the program, because it really was outstanding. And looking forward to turning our attention to our next special guest, Alan Goldberg, the native of Philadelphia, who's going to be with us in the second half of the program.
Yeah, it's going to be great. I'm interested to hear his story.
Well, Alan has conditioned 1,042 career winners. They have earned more than $32 million in purses. And Alan, nice enough to be with us for a little bit of time here on Trainer Talk tonight. Alan, thanks for taking the time.
Put it on and get a fork and put it on your plate.
Put it on my plate. Alan, are you there?
There you go. Yes, hello.
Welcome to the program. How are you?
Good.
Good, good. I mentioned those 1,042 career winners and $32 million in purse earnings. Impressive numbers.
Long time.
Yeah, you're a native of Philadelphia. How does Alan Goldberg get hooked on horse racing?
Well, it's kind of an interesting story. I went to school at Drexel. Used to go to Garden State, close by. And when I graduated, I didn't have anything to do, so I decided to go to California, but I didn't have any money. So I decided we'd stop at Barry Weisman. We stopped at Aqueduct. We'll walk Hots for a couple of weeks. We knew somebody who lived close to Aqueduct. And get some money and then go on to California. And then we just stayed.
And that was it. It was that simple.
Walter Kelly.
Now, when you were growing up, were you around racing at all? Did you have any exposure to it?
Yeah. I mean, I went to the races.
Yeah. But it's not like you had a family that was involved with it, or like so many of the other trainers do?
No.
So did you kind of learn on your own, or were there people that helped you along the way?
Basically, Walter Kelly. I don't know whether you, this might have been before your time. Walter Kelly trained for Elmendorf years ago.
Okay.
And then he backed up. He didn't want to train so many horses. So he had, when I went to work for him, I think he had maybe at the most a dozen. And that was all he would keep. But he was a pretty good horseman. And, you know, he taught me a lot.
Talk about getting that first job walking Hots. You show up at the track, say, hey, I want to walk some Hots. How'd you get into that?
Basically, that was it, you know. Showed up in the morning. He didn't pay me. He said, I'll teach you, but I'm not going to pay you. I mean, he was cheap. But,
and that's how a lot of small trainers live.
You know, Lefty Nickerson, he was in the next one. Come on, I want you to see my college kids. They learned how to be dumb. And, you know, and but he did, you know, try and teach me.
Well, Brett Calhoun told us in the first half of the show that he went to Texas Tech, and it was originally completely racing unrelated. It was for a different career. How about you when you went to Drexel? Was that
business?
Was it business?
Yeah. And that was because engineering was too hard.
And that's one of the most important things when you're training horses, is to pay attention to the business. That must give you a slight edge.
That's where a lot of people go wrong. It's hard business to make any money in. I mean,
Did you attend all 4 years at Drexel?
Yep. I did actually graduate. I don't know how, looking back, but I did.
Did you used to sneak off and get to the races when you were in college,
too? Yeah, well, yeah. And it was funny. There were a couple guys there, Mig and Mac, and they had a sandwich business. And they actually went to school, but at around 11 o'clock, they'd start to sell sandwiches off a truck. And we were friends, so they always had cash. So they'd sell the sandwiches, and then we'd all go to the races.
How long did the sandwich business last?
Well, I don't know. Until they graduated, anyway.
They had cash flow.
Right, with cash flow, that's more appropriate.
So how old were you when you finally did make the decision, hey, this is what I want to do,
I
don't want to be a business?
Well, I worked only a couple of weeks, and I said, oh, man, this is great. I was 21. I was like 71, 72.
And I imagine your parents were thrilled after sending you to Drexel that you were going to get in the horse business.
Yeah, you know, they never said anything.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, you know, which was hard to believe, but, you know.
Were they supportive of your decision?
Basically. You know, I mean, I thought it was great. What could be better? You wake up early, you work, then you go to the races the rest of the day, and hope you had enough money to eat. And, you know, you do the same thing the next day.
Yeah, what is it about racing that really did capture you and say, hey, I want to do this for a living?
I think I just like the horses. And that really, now, today, I like the horses and the training a lot more than the racing. I could care less if I ever go to a race. But I like the morning activity.
Yeah.
Yeah, all the horses are champions in the morning, and you get that.
Yeah, until you find out.
Yeah. Yeah, but that morning, I think the morning's the best time because you are with the animals, and you get to touch them and be with them. You know, when you put the saddle on them for a race, and then you put a jock on them, it's in God's hands after that, and then you got to deal with the disappointment.
That's the culmination, but I mean, just to kind of get them there, and you know, I mean, every day there's something bad happens. Yeah, but then there's some good too. You know, every once in a while you have a horse that, you know, you like, and the horse turns out.
So you work with Walter Kelly from what, 71 to 73, and then in 74 you decide to start your own stable?
74, see, Barry Weisbord and I were partners, and I would say he was the brains, you know, and we might have had a half dozen horses or so. But then he was very much interested in the breeding aspect of the business. And we got involved with stallion chairs. I mean, King Emperor, Halo, and we made money. And over the years, I've made a lot of money with the stallion chairs, much more so than training horses.
So even though that wasn't your focus,
that was his field of expertise, and I just would go in on all the deals.
Uh-huh.
You know, and he had a bloodstock business, and you know, we were partners. But I mean, I can remember we bought a share in Halo. It was $10,000 a year for 3 years. Well, we had the first $10,000, but after that, we didn't. And Joe Hickey ran Winfield Farms. He said, "Boys, what did you expect? You knew you had to come up with another $10,000. You know, and we didn't have it." And I guess we ended up borrowing it from somebody, and in the middle of his career, I think those shares were selling for like $300,000-$500,000.
Yeah. Talking with trainer Alan Goldberg.
You know, but that was the home run in the business for me.
Trainer Alan Goldberg, our special guest on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So 1974, you go out on your own. Was Walter Kelly encouraging you to do that, or do you say, hey, you need
a
little more time with me?
We bought a horse from Alan Jerkins, a horse called Little Red Pet. And Little Red Pet had a fractured sesamoid, but he was okay. He had been rehabilitated. And I would say at that time, I don't think we really knew that much, but knew we wanted to get started. And I think the horse ran in Barry's name, and he was second 4 times in a row. And actually, he was running, you know, 12.5 or something like that. And, you know, it was, you know, he was, then he got claimed. Dewey Smith claimed the Fraudley Farm. And then we were out of business, and we claimed, there's a funny story. So now there's a $6,200 or $6,500 claiming race at Monmouth.
All right.
And there's 3 horses that look good in the race. There's a horse called Algernon who was dropped from 10, and I knew had a little angle, but he was solid. There was a horse called Legion who had just won for a nickel, and had some turf pedigree who looked like he could be all right. And then I'm not sure the other, Helio Rise or Helio something, who was just a solid horse. So I went for the safe horse, Algernon. And Barry wanted to claim Legion. He said he might be okay on the turf. A guy by the name of George Jobley had him. So we claimed Algernon. He came back. He was sore. We're out of business. Legion went on to run second in the Hialeah Turf Cup and really be a good horse. And then we were out of business for a while, and we came back. So whenever Philadelphia Park opened the first year, we brought Algernon back. I went to I was painting houses for a while for a friend of mine, and went back when he came back, and he won a race or two. And then we kind of got started. You know, he had some owners over there that, you know, claimed some horses and stuff like that. But I think that was 74, 75, something like that.
And Barry stuck with you even after that whole Legion thing, huh?
Yeah.
Does he still
well, he
give you a hard time about it?
He was out of the back of his car, so it was, you know, he wasn't doing that great either. Yeah.
Couldn't pick on you too much, huh?
Yeah.
So, all right, that's 74. Eventually, you get to safely kept in 1989
well,
and 90,
that,
but bridge that gap.
We hooked up with Betty Marcus. Betty Marcus was heir to Q-tips. And she had money. And she took a liking to Barry. And, you know, we got some nice horses for her. Filly called Mazaleka, who was a pretty good filly and actually became a pretty good broodmare. Top Socialite. I mean, there were some good horses then. I think that was probably in the early 80s, maybe. You know, and she had about 20, 25 horses. She had a lot of horses.
Yeah, Mazaleka was outstanding. She was really good.
Yeah. And, you know, that she was a cut below being a real good turf filly, but they didn't write the three-quarter turf races like they do now. And she was the best in the country at that. I ran her 5/8 at Monmouth, and Bracali rode her. And it was the first time we tried her on the turf. She was getting beat on the dirt, second, third. And I said to him, what do you think? And she came from last flying and just got beat. He says, oh, I don't think she likes the turf. Well, she went on to run a bunch of stakes on the turf after that. You know.
Never listen to your jock.
But she was a good filly. Yeah. Let me know
what you see back. Alan, did you ever, when you were going through some of the struggles, you mentioned you were out of the business a couple of times, you were painting houses. Did you ever think of just giving it up?
Nah, not really. I always was somewhat optimistic, you know, that everything's going to be all right.
How do you keep that faith and keep persevering through those times?
I don't know. I was young then.
You know. Didn't know any better?
Yeah, probably that was it. Seriously, you know. But, you know, you're young. I don't know. I've been married for 37 years. My wife had a job, so she was making some money. And we didn't have any kids for that first 7 or 8 years. So, I mean, you don't really have that much responsibility.
That makes it easy. Easier.
Yeah.
Takes the pressure off.
Yeah.
All right, now, how many kids do you have now?
Two boys.
Are they in the business at all?
They walked Hots for me, and they said, Dad, this is ridiculous. Why would anyone want to get up this early every day?
So they had no interest?
Nah.
But what do they do?
One's an engineer and one's going back to school.
Drexel?
Nah, he went to the older one went to Northeastern, and the other one's going to try and do something with hospital stuff. I don't know. He's been a little bit of a project too.
Yeah, what's harder, training the kids or training the horses?
I would say it depends on the kid, depends on the horse.
And your wife, Ann, was that a racetrack meeting?
No, actually, she is an artist now, and she was in art school, and she was a roommate of Barry Weisbord's sister.
So it's
that's how I met her.
Obvious, Barry's been a huge influence in your life many, many ways. That's wild.
And, of course, you're still involved with Barry. Richard Santulli, another one of your longtime clients.
Now, Richard came on board with Safely Kept.
Okay.
And that was just a lucky thing, because in this business, you have to get the right horse for the right person. And he was the right, she was the right horse, and he was the right person.
How come?
Because, you know, you can do great for somebody, and if you just don't hit it off, it doesn't matter. You're not going to get any more horses. With him, you know, we have a great relationship. He's just a wonderful person. You know, I can't say enough good things about him. You know, he takes winning, losing the same. I mean, you know, you tell him a horse can't run, and he just paid, you know, $500,000. He says, okay, get rid of him. I mean, there's no second guessing. You know, years ago I had horses for Ken Ramsey when he first got in the business. And at the time he hadn't learned that it didn't matter what you paid for them. It's what they were worth at the time.
Right.
You know, so he knows that now.
Are you still in touch with Ken Ramsey?
No. I must have got sacked 15 years.
So, all right, so Richard comes on board. You have Safely Kept, 89, 90. Tell us that story.
He didn't have a lot of money. When I say not a lot of money, I don't know what he had, maybe $15 million or something. And he said to me, don't worry. At some point, I'm going to have a lot of money, and we're going to have a big stable. And he was right. You know, he sold his business for $700 million, and, you know, he was flush.
What's the Safely Kept story? Take us through that career.
I went down to Merlin to look at her. She had broken her maiden, maybe had been second, and Barry knew David Hayden owned her, and he wanted to sell her. And I came back, I said, she's gorgeous, beautiful horse. You know, she's got a little splint, might bother her, but other than that, we ought to buy her. And we bought her. And I think I owned a piece of her at the time. I couldn't wait to sell. You know.
Good call.
I didn't want to have any money tied up in a horse, but she was great. You breeze her a half and 50, a half and 47, it didn't matter. She just would, you know, do her thing. You know, she made it easy.
What do you remember about that first trip to the Breeders' Cup with her in 89?
You know, Gulfstream was a funny place. I thought we won. Mm-hmm. You know, I couldn't get outside. I couldn't see. It was mobbed. You know, I thought she won, but I wasn't close. And at that time when she was three, I didn't think any horse could beat her. I thought she was that good. You know, that's, you know, how good she was.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, they all get beat. She could run her, and she wouldn't, you know, and some of the spots we ran her, she didn't have to be 100% to beat those horses. She was just better than them.
How about the 1990 Breeders' Cup sprint?
Well, you know.
A little bit better.
She jumped this shadow, and I saw, you know, and then she came back and won. And I mean, she was game to come back even, you know. And I think one of those reporters said, you know, you were lucky to win. I said, nah, she'd have won anyway. But that, yeah, that was great. You know.
Where'd you watch that race? Could you get a view of that one?
Actually, you know, outside with the boss. He was next to me.
Well, that's always good.
Yeah.
Talk about some of the other horses, Alan, that you're never going to forget, whether they were when you were just getting started or later in your career.
Well, we had a little thing called Salmony. And this is a funny story. You remember Buddy Lettman?
Yeah.
Buddy Lettman ran a horse for about 10,000 or 12,000. And I had watched her, and she was a three-year-old filly against older fillies, and I claimed her. And she didn't run that great that day. And we were in the same clocker stand at Monmouth. And he said, son, you claimed a good horse. This is what you need to do with this horse. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. He said, the guy owed me money. I'm just, you know, I got my money. I'm glad I got rid of her. Well, she won five in a row and was claimed. I think Stanley Huff claimed her for $40,000 in New York. And at the time, that was big, big money, you know. But he was, you know, real good about it, you know. Buddy, you know, this is do this. You know, I should have done that. I didn't feel like it. The guy owes me money. But, you know, if you do it, she's going to win a bunch of races. So to always remember her. And then, you know, there's a bunch of horses through the years you remember. I had a horse years ago that we bought from the chief, Red Radish. And why do I remember? He would train great, and we ran him. He didn't run that good. We took a chip out of his knee, and we're bringing him back, and he was breezing unbelievable. And we ran him in Philly Parks, and he didn't, you know, bet on him. He didn't run any good. And, you know, next time we didn't bet on him, he paid $58. Mm. But I happened to be eating lunch that day at this little deli, Jack's Deli in Philly. Great guy who owned it. I told him to bet, and then we never had to pay for food there again. That was great.
Those are the best.
But, I mean, there's so many. You know, I had a horse called Subpet Surge. Subpet Surge couldn't have looked any better. You know, little horse, thought he could run 3/4 and 13. You know, ready to run, ran him cheap, bet on him, didn't run a jump. Ran him again, didn't bet on him, didn't run a jump. I gave him away to a guy by the name of Baden Hughes. Now, Baden Hughes wasn't much horse trainer, never did anything with the horse. The stall was filthy, doomed. $100, here he comes. You know.
Wow.
Things happen. It's funny business.
Trainer Alan Goldberg, our special guest on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Alan, what would you consider to be your best training job?
Well, no, you know, we had a few of those horses that ran at Colonial. We had a horse called Strike a Deal, who was just a cut below from really being great. I mean, he made over $1 million. And then New York Bred we had an even tail. You know, we ran him on the Polio up there in Canada. He paid like $50 or something. And, you know, I thought he would run good on the Poly. You know, he was a long shot. We shipped him up. That was only a couple years ago. I don't know. I mean, you know, there's a lot of horses that are difficult. But the good ones make it easy.
Yeah, and you said that you learned a lot from working with Walter Kelly. What are some of those things that you took away from being with him that you still incorporate today?
Main thing was to just do what you do and don't change. You know, because you're going to go through ups and downs and try to stay steady. You know, I mean, if the horses are running well and you're doing something, well, now when they go bad, don't change everything.
Yeah.
Because they're going to come back around, you know.
That's hard to do, isn't it?
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. Yeah, and I've been lucky out here. We have a very good vet, you know, Dr. Wise, who's, you know, so we have a full-time vet all the time out here. So anytime you have a problem, you can jump on it right away. You know, that's it makes it a lot easier.
Talk about your operation now. You mentioned claiming a lot of horses earlier in your career. Is it still pretty much based on claiming horses, or do you go to the sales more?
I haven't claimed the horse in 20 years.
Okay.
But you know, we get up and it's funny, this year, the boss kept a lot of the good yearlings that are now two. Most years he sells all the good ones, and what we get is what's left over. You know, this one got hurt, this one there, this couldn't make the sale. Like last week we ran a Smart Strike for Maiden 20 out of a great winning mare, Sand Springs, and he won. But you know, 2 weeks before the sale, he ran through a fence, and he looks like hand grenades went off all four legs. You know, it's compromised, but that's, you know, you get a lot of horses like that. You know, we have a horse called Blown Save that's in tomorrow that they wanted to put down. He was so crooked. And, you know, we ran him cheap, a Smart Strike. He's won 6 of 8.
Wow.
And he's a runner. But, you know, he's got issues because he's just so crooked. And, I mean, that's what Jules, I don't know if you remember Jules.
Yeah.
Jules, we bought back for $50,000, but I don't even know whether it was live money. He was crooked. But this year, we'll see how we do, because he said, screw it, let's keep some good ones. And he did.
Well,
I got a filly in tomorrow. I mean, she's not dead tight or anything, but I think she's a nice filly. Out of a mare called Social Queen, who was a pretty good filly. And usually he would sell those horses, but he kept a bunch this year, and we'll see.
Well, we can count on seeing some two-year-olds in the winner's circle, it sounds like.
Yeah, you know, so we have some nice two-year-olds, and he's been buying some older horses. That Laughing he bought Tannery. He just bought a little filly from Timmy Saltzman called Sensible Lady, who's a pretty nice filly. Yeah, she's actually going to come up from her own tomorrow. So he's been buying some older horses, and we kept some decent, you know, yearlings, and that are now two. We didn't buy any. We haven't bought any yearlings for the last couple of years. And so we'll see how we do. The pressure factor, there wasn't much pressure when you had all the buybacks and bad horses, but now there's a little pressure because some of these horses are pretty sweet.
Yeah, how much are you involved in that selection process, Alan, when they're selecting young horses?
Not a whole lot. I mean, we'll go down to the sale and, you know, basically we had Mike Ryan buy some horses for a while and he did okay. And, a few people, but it's kind of time consuming. You know, I don't really have the time to get away, you know, for 4 or 5 days. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, 7 days a week still.
Yeah. Do you have any other hobbies outside of, I know you play golf.
Playing golf today in about 45 minutes.
What's your handicap?
It keeps going up. At one time, I think I was about 11 or 12, but I'm on my way up to 17, 18 now.
Well, Ian Wilkes.
Another year or two, I'll be in the 20s.
Ian Wilkes threw down the gauntlet and challenged me here on the radio publicly. And so now I have to play with him up in Saratoga. Maybe we can get you out with us if you're up there.
Sounds good.
All right, Alan, we'll let you go and do your thing. Thank you so much for being here with
us
on Trainer
welcome.
Talk.
Bye-bye.
Alan Goldberg. Fun story.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting life. Very much similar to Bobby Frankel's story, getting a job at the track and becoming a trainer.
Yeah. And it worked for one other individual and then went out on his own. Brett Calhoun didn't work for anybody, right? He just started training for his dad and with his horses and kind of went from there. So.
Yeah, I worked for Julio Canani. Some people would say that's like not working for anybody.
How long did you work for Julio?
A year. I worked for Julio. I worked for a guy named Doug Udodge, who was, his family was the leading breeders in Arkansas. And I worked for Doug for about 6 months. And then when I went back to California, I was working for the racing form when I worked for Doug and still working for the racing form when I started working for Julio. And how I met Julio in the press box at Santa Anita. He was doing the race results in Spanish. He had a radio show.
Oh, wow.
And he was doing the race results in Spanish. So I was in the press box making the charts for the form every day, and I met Julio. And one morning I went out to visit him at the barn, and it was freezing cold. It was like one of those 18-degree days. And he hands me this horse, Kennel Miki. He says, here, walk this horse. It'll warm you up. You know, he didn't want to pay any help either. So I started going out every morning and walking hots and working for Julio. And that's how I met Bobby Frankel, and that's how I met Umberto Ascanio, who taught me how to take care of horses' legs. Brett Calhoun talked about having all those horses and learning a lot. And that's how I did. I went stall to stall with Umberto and looked at legs all the time. So it's good education.
Well, a couple of great stories on Trainer Talk tonight. Brett Calhoun in the first half and Alan Goldberg in the second half of the program. They will both receive gifts courtesy of EPO Equine and Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Make sure you check them out and support those companies that support us here on Trainer Talk each and every week, and we certainly thank them for being part of the program. If you did miss any portion of this show, a podcast will be available for you later on our website, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Don't forget, we're back tomorrow. Yes, 4th of July. We are here with you for all that big racing from 3 to 7 Eastern Time with HRN Live. And, of course, our BristNet.com call-in show tomorrow night from 6 to 7 Eastern Time. Don't forget to call in. We'll have some special gifts from Brist to give to all of our callers who make it on the show tomorrow night, Friday 3 to 7, and our Express Bet Weekend Stakes Preview. So a lot of things to look forward to. We'll be heading to Calder tomorrow morning for the Summit of Speed. You can check out a complete schedule, horseracingradio.net. Going to be fun, JT.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Nice races at Calder.
For our producer, Lee Delapina, Jude Fell, the pontiff of the Pick Four, I am Mike Penna, and we will talk to you later on this week on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk.
Good night, Barbados.